Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island Beer Company, a Chicago craft brewery that works to innovate new ways to brew and age beer. More at gooseisland.com. You don't need to be the only beer you drink. We just want to be the best beer you drink.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and later in the show, we're going to review an album called Scenery from Emily King. Now, she's a singer-songwriter, Jim. I would put her in that category.
Yep.
But she expands it into funk, soul, R&B. She's got a unique take on that. We're going to talk about that record later.
That's later in the show, Greg. You are right. But first, Walk This Way. That is Run DMC's 1986 version of the Aerosmith song from their 1975 record, Toys in the Attic. The refresh track, the reimagined, rebooted song, ended up being a complete surprise hit for both bands. You know, by the mid-1980s, Aerosmith was far from their 1970s heyday. Run DMC, consisting of rappers Joseph Run Simmons and Daryl DMC McDaniels, as well as the great Jam Master Jay Jason Mizell on the Wheels of Steel. They were young. They were an up-and-coming rap group. They'd had two solid selling albums under their belt. But like nearly every hip-hop act in the early 80s, they had not crossed over into the mainstream. That all changed when Run DMC teamed up with Aerosmith's Steven Tyler and Joe Perry to record a new version of their classic rock standard.
And that 1986 version of Walk This Way became an international top 10 hit, one of the first rap songs with that distinction. Washington Post reporter Jeff Edgers writes all about it in his new book, Walk This Way, Run DMC, Aerosmith, and the Song That Changed American Music Forever. That is quite a claim. We recently spoke with him about the book, and according to Jeff, there is a common misconception that Walk This Way basically made Run DMC's career.
There are a few things in this book that I hope will change minds. And one, I think, false perception out there in the universe is that Aerosmith, these rock heroes, rock stars, you know, helped out these young rappers and gave them a career. When in fact, Run DMC were in many ways already superstars. I mean, they were the first rap supergroup. And Aerosmith, at that point in 1986, they couldn't have been more washed up. I mean, I remember it because I was 14 years old and I grew up, you know, in Boston. So I remember when Aerosmith, Joe Perry, Steven Tyler got back together again and they went on the Back in the Saddle tour in 1984. That was one of my earliest concerts. So I remember that. But then they came back in 1985 with Done with Mirrors. Done with Mirrors was largely seen as a failure. So that's the point where, you know, there's this suggestion while they're out on tour with Ted Nugent opening for them, where but they're, you know, they're in Philadelphia playing a concert, and on an off day, they get like, you know, Tyler and Perry are paid $4,000 to come up to New York and work with these guys in Run DMC.
We need to have some context here from a standpoint of, I mean, radio was segregated. MTV wasn't playing black artists, much less hip-hop. But it was clearly speaking to a new generation of listeners in a way that Aerosmith's music no longer was at that time. Aerosmith was this big band from the 70s, but as you said, by the mid-80s, it seemed like they were washed up and on their last legs. So it sounded like Run DMC was in the driver's seat here, right? Why did they even agree to get into the studio with these washed-up rockers?
Well, Run DMC, you know, I mean, Joe Simmons, Run, Daryl McDaniels, DMC, and Jam Master Jay, they were kind of willing to do what their producers said. I mean, if Larry Smith before, you know, who produced their first two records, had a suggestion, they listened to it and did it, you know. Rick Rubin later, you know, they did it. Russell Simmons, their you know, Joe's older brother who managed them. So that wasn't really the issue. And the fact is, Run DMC, they were the first rap supergroup, but they weren't a supergroup in the conventional sense of the word, because there was a huge problem with the way that radio worked back then and MTV worked. Now, you said, you know, the idea that they didn't play black artists on MTV, and MTV was taking its cue from rock radio, and rock radio would play a certain kind of black artist, but not another kind of black artist. So if you're Billy Ocean, or you're Michael Jackson or Dionne Warwick, you're cool, right? You're not going to be getting on there if you're Tila Rock or the Fat Boys or Run DMC. Mm-hmm. It's just not going to happen. 2 years ago, a friend of mine asked me to say some MC rhyme. So I said this rhyme I'm about to say. The rhyme was there. They played some rap videos, but they played them late at night. They weren't in heavy rotation. So that's, you know, one piece of it. And then the fact is, rock radio was not playing rap at all. So MTV was taking its cue from rock radio, and rock radio wasn't playing rap. So for Run DMC, this represented a huge opportunity, a chance to break through on another level, to go from, you know, having a gold record to having a multi-platinum record, and to reach a whole different audience. That's how Rick Rubin, who is one of the people who clearly conceived the idea, viewed it.
Yeah, tell us about Rubin's involvement.
You know, he is basically hailed back then as the king of rap. And I spoke with him quite a bit about this, because it's not really fair. I mean, one of the first interviews I had with Daryl McDaniel, DMC, he said, look, the real king of rap was Larry Smith. And he's talking about the guy who produced the first two Run DMC records, the Houdini records, you know, and the Fat Boys. Because Larry Smith is the guy who in many ways brought electric guitars into rap, and also created the beats on things like Sucker MCs, the beats that would be replicated everywhere, and created this style of hip hop. With a 1, 2, 3, 3 to 2, 1, my man Larry Lab, my name's DJ Run. We do it in the place with the high and the bass. I'm rapping to the rhythm, want to wipe it on my face. Go uptown and come down to the ground. You sucker MC, you sad face clown. You $5 boy, and I'm $1 million.
Mainstream rock radio was not very open-minded at this time in terms of its willingness to play rap alongside rock. But Rick Rubin wasn't the only one interested in crossing those genres. You know, both Rick and Run DMC were based in New York City. I was there as a student at NYU at that time, and the cutting-edge underground scene was full of mixing and matching that wasn't happening on the radio. You had left-field club bands like Liquid Liquid on the bill with hip-hop acts like KRS-One, all this downtown art rock noise, Boogie Down Productions. It was a really inspiring time.
One of the few people I didn't talk to was Glenn O'Brien.
Mm. Yeah, you know, for people who don't know, he had a cable access New York television show. He was a culture tastemaker. He wrote for Andy Warhol's Interview, right?
Well, yeah, Glenn O'Brien, I mean, he edited Madonna's book Sex, but the Glenn O'Brien that I knew was not the Glenn O'Brien I wanted to talk to. It was the one I wanted to talk to was the guy who did what you just mentioned, TV Party. You know, in the late 70s, they learned that there were all these open spaces on cable access, and he started this show, and he did it with Chris Stein, you know, Blondie, and it basically is a visual you know, record of what you're just talking about, this idea of crossing black and white and different genres and everything. You know, you could turn that on and you'd see Debbie Harry in the corner on a pogo stick.
So just as a historic reference, the pogo has been done like this.
Mm-hmm. Fab Five Freddy would be manning the camera.
Somebody was doing graffiti in the background. Yeah.
Yeah, you'd see artists, you know, in the background. You'd see David Byrne show up, or like, you know, one of the Sex Pistols, and they might have an improvised performance, you know, of something. But Glenn O'Brien is the guy who basically took Chris Stein and Debbie Harry down to see Grandmaster Flash, and I think probably you know, the funky 4+1. And as you know, Blondie then did that section in Rapture, which is kind of rap badly, but rap.
Right.
Fab Five Freddy told me everybody slide. DJ spinning, I said my. Flash is fast, Flash is cool. Francois Safar, Flash ain't no dupe, and you don't stop. Sure shot, go out to the parking lot.
And you've got her putting the funky 4+1 on Saturday Night Live, which is totally foreign to all their viewers, but amazing. So you do have something going on there where there's a sense of, like, there are no rules here, there are no boundaries. You can do whatever you want.
Well, the no rules, no boundaries things, I think, applies a lot to, you know, hip-hop DJs, too, because it seemed like they were very genre-agnostic from the get-go. They were willing to sample anything or take a breakbeat from any record if it was funky and danceable. And that seemed to be the case of why a song like Walk This Way from this prototypical hard rock band ended up as the bedrock for a rap song, right?
Well, Grandmaster Flash told me, I mean, he would pick the record up. I just love this idea. He would just pick up the record and look at the grooves, and he could tell whether something would be, like, usable by how what the grooves look like. I don't understand how you do that, but he did. And Walk This Way, the beat was apparently just gold. When I say the beat, I mean, before even the guitar comes in.
Yeah, the drums.
and if the voice comes in, then you had failed as a DJ. You were a total joke. So all these guys, they didn't know Walk This Way. They didn't know Aerosmith. A lot of the DJs also would, like, black out with marker the songs on their records so they didn't get stuff stolen. So, like, for Run DMC, even in 1986... they didn't know that as Walk This Way. They knew it as Toys in the Attic, number 4.
But they could relate to it. They heard the beat. They got it.
Well, they could relate to it, but they also couldn't relate to what came after the beat.
That is Jeff Edgers, author of Walk This Way, Run DMC, Aerosmith, and the song that changed American music forever. We're talking to Jeff about the making of that record. The rock and hip-hop had come together seamlessly on Walk This Way. The studio sessions weren't exactly a love fest.
I remembered when I was 15 years old, MTV News doing like a 90-second clip on their news of the one day that they came together. And just the reporter in me said to the head of Viacom, Doug Herzog, I said, Doug, you guys have any more in the, like, in the vaults from that? And he found, like, it was like 15 or 18 minutes of unseen footage shot that day and gave it to me. And I watched that with Run in his house. I sent it to Rick Rubin. He watched it. I sent it to Daryl. None of them remembered it. But there's an amazing moment in there where Jam Master Jay brings Tyler and Perry over to the turntables, and he's showing them. He's got Walk This Way on either, you know, two turntables, and he's showing them how it works. And they're watching. Who knows what they're on at that point? But what I don't think they understand, and they sort of half understand it, is that he's showing them that as soon as they come in, basically that song is dead to him. Because to them, that singing was, you know, they said it, you know, when his words came in, they called it Hillbilly Bull S. Like, we can't swear, right?
Right.
They were terrified of that song when they were told to listen to it and write down the words. There was no Genius or Google lyrics, you know. They were told to scribble down the words on a yellow notepad. And as soon as they started hearing them, I think those words actually are quite rap-like. I think that the rhythm's in them, and I think there's a whole thing with Steven Tyler, the good Steven Tyler, when he's on. Like, there's something very rhythmic about that.
Oh, yeah.
That.
Well, well Tyler's a drummer, like, too, you know.
There's something amazing about that, but the fact is, the version of Walk This Way that we in white suburbia understand and the version that the DJs understood were completely different things.
What about the interaction between Steven Tyler, Joe Perry, and Run and DMC in the studio? They really weren't friendly at all, right? I mean, it was kind of a chilly atmosphere in the studio. Did your reporting show that, Jeff?
You know, you're reading the quotes on a page, and you're saying, oh, they're all saying good things about each other. But I had the benefit of watching the video that hadn't been released, you know, in the archives of them being interviewed together. And it's really funny to watch knowing what I know. And Rick Rubin actually told me he knew it at the time, too, so he was a little uncomfortable, which is, it's not really clear what either side knew about each other, you know? I mean, Tyler can kind of talk his way through anything.
Yeah, we've heard him. We've heard him on the radio before, yeah.
Yeah, and I like this style because there's a lot of electric guitar in it, you know? And
finally.
Yeah, and it caught my ear. So when I found out about this, I was like, you know, real excited. As you can tell. Well, let's have music through the talking, you know.
And Perry's just, you know, yeah, I like their music. You know, that, you know, he can do that and mumble and be the mystic.
Yeah.
But, you know, basically DMC doesn't say anything. Run says a few things, and it's not clear whether he's referring to the group or the song. And at one point you see, you know, Jam Master Jay almost like saving face going, it's my favorite song. It's our favorite song. And Rick looks at him and they do this sort of nervous laugh. It's clear that these guys have no relationship whatsoever. You know, it's not like when, you know, Whitney Houston and Aretha Franklin would do something together and, you know, Whitney would talk about how, you know, she had studied her work. I mean, they clearly were not familiar with the material. You know, like Aerosmith, I don't know what they were used to, but they had had years and years of being treated like rock stars. There was, you know, no pretense that they were going to be treated that way. And as they're sitting there working on the song, I mean, Run and D are making up lyrics or changing lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
And Tyler's sitting there going like, no, that's not, it's not, it's Kitty, not the word with a T. And they're going, no, we're going to do it our way, you know? And no, it's not looking at D, it's looking at me. Nah, just do it. We're going to do it that way. And there's just no respect for, like, the normal respect that you would see or expect from a younger artist to these arena guys.
Yeah. So how did they come to a compromise? Run and DMC were very vocal. It seemed like they did not like these lyrics at all. How did they come to terms with actually doing something with that song beyond the breakbeat?
Well, they were forced to. I mean, that's how. They were brought into the studio, and they were, first they came in, they had some problem where Run needed a car, and Daryl was the only one with a credit card, and so he loaned him his credit card, and then Run had the car, it was like a Lincoln Town car, and he had forgotten where he parked it because he was so stoned, and then the car got stolen, and they had no knowledge of what would happen next. So they came into the studio that day. All they were talking about, they weren't like, oh, look, it's Steve Tyler and Joe Perry. I don't even know if they knew who they were. They came in and they were just, you know, what are we going to do? Am I going to have to pay for the car? And I guess, you know, Joe Perry, when I talked to him last year, he remembered that. Like, he remembered they were just something about a car. And Rick Rubin had to calm them down and explain the concept of, like, insurance and, you know, that the car would be recovered and budget would not put them in jail. They just were pushed into it because first they came in. And, you know, Tyler and Perry were just there for one day. They did their thing. Run and D didn't do a great job the first pass. I mean, we have a recording of that, which I found from the vaults, and they're just kind of goofing around and not doing a great job.
At the high school desk with the missy who was ready to play.
Play!
Wasn't she? Wasn't me. She was fooling.
And it was actually Jam Master Jay, who was actually younger, but he acted older. And he was the guy who would tell them, you know, what really what to do or when to be serious. I mean, he was the one at the board when they were goofing around with, like, their, you know, their whoppers and trying to get out of there. And he actually called them back in and said, you guys are going to have to come in here. I'm not using the same language. I have the same language in the book. But, you know, you guys are going to have to come back in here because you're going to look like idiots. You know, you're going to look like fools if you don't do this right. And so they had to be pushed back into the studio. But even then, after that song was recorded, that was not a song that they trotted out when they started their tour. You know, they often wouldn't play it. They were far more excited to play My Adidas.
My Adidas! Walk through cops and doors and roam all over Coliseum floor. I stepped on stage at Live Aid. All the people gave and the poor got paid.
When we come back, we'll talk more with Jeff Edgers about Walk This Way and its legacy. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.